Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The selfie. For good or bad, it has become a major part of our culture, sometimes criticized as a symbol of our increasingly self-absorbed society. Could be a good thing, according to others. Tech writer Rachel Syme suggests that the thousands of pictures people post of themselves on Facebook and Twitter are signs of ambition. Her piece, Selfie, The Revolutionary Potential of Your Own Face, was recently published on Medium.com. She joins us now. Welcome to the show, Rachel Syme.
Thank you for having me.
You start your article using the example of a lady sitting at a cafe. She takes one selfie, then five, then 25. I think when people watch that process, that's what looks pretty self-absorbed.
Yes, and what I started with that image in my mind when I started working on the piece, which is, you know, in many people's mind, a laughable image. But I think there's a lot more going on under the surface there, and I wanted to figure out what that was.
And what did you figure out?
Well, just that I found out that selfies are not necessarily just a narcissism machine. They're a communication tool and a new kind of language that people are using to speak to one another about how they want to be seen and how they want other people to see them. And it creates communities of looking. So what she's doing at that table is not necessarily putting a bunch of pictures of herself on the internet to get validation, but she is communicating. And there is waves and waves of people doing this.
Some people do it more than others, though.
Sure. I mean, people's habits vary.
Mm-hmm. Does that tell you anything, though, when someone does a selfie and changes up their status photo every week?
I think it tells me that they're a pretty creative person who'd like to be seen in a sort of prismatic, many different ways. I think that people who update their pictures a lot are people who want to be seen from many different angles, right?
Yep.
That would be my interpretation of it. And not necessarily feeding the beast with pictures of your face just to get the validation. I think validation is part of it. And by the way, I think we're all worthy of validation. I think anybody who has a body is worthy of being seen and appraised and noticed and taking up space in the world. But I also think that it's not just about the validation. There's so much more going on than that.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and we're talking about the selfie. And I would love to hear from listeners who have strong feelings about the selfie, and in particular, people who like taking selfies, and to tell us why they do it or why they think they're doing it, and share that. Those thoughts with my guest, Rachel Syme. She has an article that just that we'll post a link to about this topic on our website at wosu.org/allsides. You can call us at 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why do you take selfies? Or why do you think you take them? What is a selfie by your definition? Is there a definition?
Yes, there's a working definition of the selfie. A selfie is a picture taken of yourself by yourself with the intention of being shared. And once it is shared, it becomes a selfie. And so if you take a picture privately and just keep it on your phone, that's not technically a selfie. Or if somebody else takes a picture of you and then you post it to Instagram, that's also not technically a selfie. It must be taken by yourself and posted by yourself.
And what's the significance of sharing?
Oh, the significance of sharing is huge. That's the entire thing. I think I say somewhere in the piece that the taking of the selfie and the sharing of the selfie work in a kind of electric tandem. It's a two-part process. It's creative expression of your own, and then it's dissemination of that expression. So once you share your selfie, it goes off to have adventures without you. People like it. People look at it. People share it. People comment on it. And so the sharing is everything. That is how you are speaking the language, so to speak.
And when somebody takes several selfies of themselves, then they go through it, they edit it, they're kind of curating. Here's what I'm looking and feeling like right now.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think the power to curate your own image in a world where people have pretty small control over everything is really exciting for people to be able to have that grip on how you want to be seen. And also the ability to express yourself that way, artistically and creatively.
Oh, that's what I thought was pretty cool about your article and that whole idea of it's taking control of how people see you.
Exactly. I think so many people feel, especially when confronted with the online space, that they have so little control.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, I don't know if you've ever Googled your name and seen how other people have written about you or taken pictures of you or posted things about you. And the selfie, there's a lot of ways to take back control. People do it through all social media and the expression of themselves that way. But I think the selfie is a really powerful, because images are so powerful, way to have that sense of ownership over yourself and over the way you want people to see you.
It teaches
people how you want to be seen.
And that changes from day to day.
It does. And I think the thing that I was really heartened to discover when I started talking to people about their selfies, I interviewed over 100 people for the piece and had people send me their selfies over the course of many months, their faces and the stories behind them. And one of the things that I found was that people aren't always just posting pictures of themselves at their happiest, most beatific, pristine moments. People are posting vulnerable selfies, selfies when they're having a bad day. There's a kind of trend that's happening called depression selfies, where people who are not feeling their best or feeling extremely low are posting pictures of themselves to ratify their own existence and tell other people they're doing okay. There are selfies of recovery from illness. I mean, there are selfies, there are many ways to express yourself via selfies as there are people. So it's not, and I think that that changes day to day from person to person. Also, I change the way I feel every day. And so the pictures I take of myself will be different every day.
Right. They're not all with your lips puckered and your hands on your hip.
No, I think that the duck face that you're referring to is a sort of common misconception about the way selfies are taken. And that comes from, I say, the patron saint of selfies, Kim Kardashian, has posed that way quite a few times. So now it's become a kind of shorthand for mocking women taking selfies or the hyper-feminine pose. But I think that is a very narrow way to look at the medium.
Let's hear from Tanya in Columbus. You're on the air. Tanya, hi.
Hi. I actually was teasing my daughter about taking selfies recently, and I realized that she takes them for Snapchat. So she talks to her friends, and they just send pictures back and forth for, you know, hours on end.
Yeah. Snapchat is a really interesting medium for people to send selfies because they're so ephemeral. They don't last. They're just goofy. There's no filters on them, and they last a few seconds.
And they're actually, as Tanya described it, talking to each other that way. Are you there?
She's still there.
Rachel? Well, yeah, Tanya's there. But that's how she described it. They're kind of, they carry on conversations for hours on end, she said.
Absolutely. And I think there are people that send, I talk to a bunch of people that send selfies as a way to communicate with somebody long distance or even their friends from school, for example, like Tanya was talking about, that instead of sending a text message, they just send a picture of their face as a new way, a sort of human emoji, a way of saying, this is how I feel. It's a conversation that they're having.
Well, they say a picture says 1,000 words?
Worth 1,000 words,
Yeah. Yeah. Tanya, thanks a lot for that call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org and tell us about your experience with selfies. What do you think? Tell us what the idea that you relayed in your article, Rachel Syme, about how taking a selfie equates with a sign of ambition.
Well, that was something that was born out of writing about some women of the past who were photographers who took pictures of themselves before the advent of the iPhone. And one of the people that I wrote about a few different women of the past from different eras, but one of the women that I've been fascinated by for a long time is a artist named Francesca Woodman, who killed herself in her early 20s, but was an extremely ambitious young artist living in New York and took over 10,000 pictures of herself. And I saw her willfulness to put herself in the frame as a kind of ambition and as a kind of expression of her artistic statement and sensibility. And I think that same spirit and that same energy is sort of floating through the people that take selfies now. I think sometimes people think, oh, this woman just wants to, or this, you know, anyone who takes selfies, this teenager, wants to be seen and told that they look great, and that's the only validation that they need. But I think it can be a lot more about saying that you deserve to be seen and demanding that you be seen in someone's feed as a way of feeding your own ambition and saying that you belong in any given space at a certain time, which is what ambition is, right? It's saying, I've arrived and I belong.
Mm-hmm. Wendy in Columbus, you're on the air with Rachel Syme. Hi, Wendy.
Hi there.
Hi, Wendy.
Quick question for your guest. I am a listener who's in their 50s. I'm a little older, and I have teenagers who take selfies. My question mm-hmm. is, I kind of feel that selfies for people my age and older is a little, I feel it's for the younger kids. And when I see people my age constantly taking selfies, I'm a little wary, like, why do you need to take that many pictures? It's for the teens. So I'm questioning, just a question about older folks like myself taking selfies and your feelings on that.
Rachel?
Well, I'm in my 30s, so the wrinkles have started to show. I started using the internet as a teen, but I wasn't native to it the way that teenagers are today. I mean, taking a selfie to them is second nature. They can do it in their sleep. And people that are of a certain age feel a little bit resistant to that because the technology isn't native, right? It's like picking up a new instrument and figuring out how to play. But I think that the power for people to take selfies at any age is really strong. I talked to a lot of people that were over 50 who started taking selfies later in life. And their main barrier to it was the very thing you're describing, which is that it's some kind of a teenage trend, and I don't belong doing it. And or they were kind of afraid of their own face, the way they looked when they looked in the camera.
Yeah, well, I have good reason to be. I just like to say that.
I mean,
that's not you. Wait till you're, you know, whatever.
But I think that the way they're afraid of looking at themselves with fondness or desire, it feels scary and like they don't have the entitlement to do it. And I think that everybody should be entitled to look at themselves that way. And one of the things that I my mom started taking selfies in order to send them to me because I requested them from her. And now she and my father take a lot together when they're on trips. And I love getting them because I feel that that is just a wonderful way to communicate with her. And I am so happy that I have them for the future. And I think that when you're taking selfies by yourself, you may not think right now that your teenagers want to see them or that anyone wants to see them, but I can guarantee you that people will want to see them later and will want to know how you saw yourself. So if you are afraid to take them now for your own sense of self now, just think about the future and how people might see them later.
That's interesting. Wendy, thanks a lot for that call. By the way, there's a difference between a selfie and an ussie.
Yeah, an ussie is a selfie taken with another person.
And it's not the same thing.
I mean, it's an offshoot of the selfie. If you post it and you took it with the other person in the frame, but you took it yourself, it's technically a selfie. It's just a cute way of saying that it has another person in it.
Okay.
They're considered a little less controversial because it's more of an expression of, look, I have friends versus, look, I'm by myself.
And it's often you're at with friends doing something.
Yeah. You're out at a game or, you know, vacation or something like that versus I'm alone in my room bored. Let me take pictures of my face.
You focus your attention in the article predominantly on women. My experience is that lots of men take selfies.
Well, more and more, it's becoming prevalent. I think people think of it as a hyper-feminine practice, which I think is actually the wrong way to look at it. So I'm glad that you said that. But I think more and more, it's becoming kind of a gender balance. Mm-hmm. A lot of men, the original sort of men stereotypical selfie was the gym selfie.
Right.
Men who would take pictures of themselves in the mirror of the gym. But I think now more and more men are learning how to look at themselves the way that some women had before with a kind of attention and affection, and that is coming through in their selfies. Do you know men who take selfies?
Oh yeah. And it's understandable. I tell myself, well, if I had pores like theirs, I'd do it too. But let me ask you this, Rachel Syme,
sure.
what do you predict for the future? Is this going to go on, you know, into infinity as long as there's a smartphone around?
I think so. I mean, I think that it's not a trend. I think it's really important to realize that selfies are not a trend. They're a communication tool and something that has become available via the technology that evolved. It's kind of like asking whether or not email will go away. You know, it's just a new thing that exists now and is part of the way we communicate. I think that people will become much more experimental and avant-garde as more and more apps and technologies arise to allow people to play with the way they take selfies. And I think that selfies will start to be collected into museum exhibitions, into books, into photography shows. I really do think that it is a brand new beginning of a medium that will probably not be ridiculed in 100 years, but just taken as one of the many ways we express ourselves.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having me.
We'll have a link to Rachel Symes's article about the selfie. She's a freelance writer and reporter, and it was published this recently in
November 19th.
Yeah. Oh, it was November 19th. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
And it was in the
it was
Medium,
on the
medium.com. Right. Sorry about that.
Matter, which is part of medium.com.
Right.
Yeah.
We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Once again, Rachel Symes, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. This holiday season, lots of young children will receive new gadgets, including tablets or other mobile devices. The next step is to help them find the best apps to download. Joining us now is the editor of the Children's Technology Review, Warren Buckleitner. Welcome back, Warren.
Hello, Ann. How are you?
Good, thanks. There's never a shortage of apps to talk about, that's for sure.
Well, I want to clear up one thing. I do take selfies on occasion.
I tell you, most of the people I see are men taking selfies. Do you it at the gym is the question.
We have no egos. mine always end up having other people in them, though.
Okay, that's an Aussie.
I guess that's right. That's
an
Aussie.
Yeah, it's a little different, but yeah, same idea. We were going to talk about noteworthy kids apps, and you have one that you wanted to talk about, Goldilocks and Little Bear.
Yeah, we have a lot of ground to cover.
Yeah.
But that's at the top of my list right now because it's from Nosy Crow. Nosy Crow is a British publisher, and they make regular books out of paper in very innovative ways, and they've also have a series of apps. And in this one, what's great about it, it's called Goldilocks and Little Bear. So it's the the little girl and the little bear, and the story is told from the perspective of each. And if you flip the iPad over, you take the view of the other person, and it's a delightful parallel narrative that kids can explore, and it's the first time I've seen that done.
Is that the only way you interact with the story, is by flipping it back and forth?
No, there's the activities, you can touch and hear language. It's a fabulous early reading experience. It's the kind of thing that, you want to give your children quality, and that's the quality narrative. It's the kid narratives in the story are from the movie The King's Speech, so it's just a terrific quality all the way around. And when you get a good story that has, that narrative glue that's worked, what's going to happen to Goldilocks and what happens when she tries the porridge and, all of that, there's a lot of logic to it, and you kind of want to see what happens. But in this case, you get to see what happens to Little Bear when Little Bear goes into the people's house and tries all their stuff out. And so, it's not the traditional version of Goldilocks, but it's a nice 21st version. And the fact that you can jump between the two views at any moment is really a unique affordance of the iPad.
I can't think of the author right now, but it reminds me of that book, which I really liked, called The Real Story of the Three Little Pigs.
Oh, yeah. That's one of my favorite. That has the newspaper clipping
right.
from the wolf.
Yeah, from the wolf's perspective.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, it's one of the reasons you can think about getting such an expensive device and giving it to a kid. because it really lets them explore how stories work and sort of the structure. And these are obviously powerful literacy things that are hard, easier said than done.
There's another one, Dragon Box Numbers. It's by We Want to Know, and it talks about mathematics. Do the kids know they're learning it, or do they know they're eating spinach, or is it something different?
Well, in this case, it is fun enough so that a kid would want to do math because it has sort of an Angry Birds game mechanic to it. So let me dissuade the fear right there. Again, it's called Dragon Box Numbers. You may have heard of Dragon Box Algebra. It's from a studio in Norway, and it's a really wonderful. When I was a teacher, I used to use these things called Cuisenaire blocks, and they're these numbered blocks that you can line up, and the more you play with them, the more you start realizing that base 10 sort of has a geometric equivalent, and so because they're color-coded and their length.
Is this like the thing they use in Montessori schools?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And in most early childhood programs mm-hmm. have some sort of unit blocks and that kind of thing. And just imagine if those blocks could talk. Mm-hmm. And when you touch them, they say their name. And so let's say I have a 2-block and a 3-block, and I need a 5-block to fill in a puzzle. So what you do is you just kind of cram them together, and they sort of weld themselves together. And all of a sudden it says 2 + 3 = 5. And I call this a virtual manipulative. In other words, kids can sort of do the math with their fingers, and it just makes this, it's a very powerful number experience to, when all those, the units and, you know, sort of the traditional mm-hmm. validity of these blocks is combined with that dynamic gameplay.
You know, I'm playing with a children's coding app right now, and that sounds a little bit like coding, too.
Yeah, you know, actually, if you start to unpackage what is coding, mm-hmm. it is all of these things. And so, you know, it's problem solving, it's understanding and playing with quantities, it's that kind of thing. And just don't tell the kids they're doing, you know, math.
Mm-hmm. That's always the key. Leonardo's Cat is another, it's about solving logic puzzles, another thing I love to do. I find that I love kids' apps, by the way, in general for myself, but what's that all about?
Well, besides the fact that Patrick Stewart is the narrator.
Oh, wow.
He plays the role of Leonardo, and he's sort of this goofy inventor, and it's funny to hear Leonardo da Vinci, the consummate Italian with a British Patrick Stewart voice, but it works. It's actually a true fact that Leonardo da Vinci liked cats. That's something I didn't know. But the story is that Leonardo has all these inventions, and he tries them out on his cat. And the cat, obviously, it doesn't always end well for the cat. There's all these different devices, and it's really sort of like Rube Goldberg. And we've seen this kind of gameplay with The Incredible Machine, and, you know, it really works well. In this case, there's that story component of the interplay between Leonardo, a.k.a. Patrick Stewart, and his cat. There's a lot of content, 60 puzzles. It's a $3 app. Absolutely one that you'll be happy you downloaded, both for kids and adults.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about children's apps with Warren Buckleitner. He's editor of the Children's Technology Review. If you have a question or comment for Warren Buckleitner about an app you're interested in checking out, he might have, they go through hundreds of them, thousands of them. If you're interested, he may have an answer for you. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. By the way, as far as Leonardo's Cat goes, Dragon Box Numbers, and Goldilocks and Little Bear, what age groups are we talking about here?
Well, all of these have a great design, so there isn't really a bottom level. In other words, even young children can start fooling around with them. Dragon Box Numbers, for example, mm-hmm. can be used by preschoolers. But I think that so far we're pretty solid in the preschool range for the Goldilocks and Dragon Box. Leonardo is a little bit older, probably 5 or 6 and up.
Okay. And as far as it doesn't end well for the cat, there's no violence, I hope.
No, it's all comical. He does fall into some boiling lava at a time, but it's done in a way so that you know that this cat has more than 9 lives.
Okay. Minecraft, story mode. So Minecraft is real familiar to a lot of children.
Yeah.
I guess you should describe it. It's used for coding lessons too, I know.
Right, yeah. In case you've been stuck in an elevator for the last 10 years, Minecraft is the block building game that I think Lego wishes they invented, but it was recently purchased by Microsoft for $2.5 billion with a B dollars. And you know, that's a 4-year success story. That's incredible from a business angle, mm-hmm. but the reason it's so successful is that it empowers kids, and it's very simple graphics. You can build mines, you can go underground, or you can build houses or you know, cruise ships and anything else. And there's a lot of power behind it. And the reason that this new app is important to talk about is it's called Minecraft Story Mode. It's the first time that somebody has laid a narrative over Minecraft. So they're characters in a Minecraft setting. They move through and they try to enter a building contest. And there's a lot of comical interplay between the characters.
Now, do people who already own a copy of Minecraft have to pay extra for the story mode?
Absolutely.
Everything costs. Okay, nothing's free.
Well, the way this one works is some of them, there's a kind of app called Freemium. This is called, some people call these paymiums. In other words, you pay the $5 to download the app, and then you earn the right to download more content from within the app. So it gives you the first chapter for free, and there's a lot to it. You know, I played with it for a full hour and more. And plus, there's little mini games that you can play. But there's no building, and that's important to say. So once you finish the first chapter, find out what happened in chapter two, you have to pay another couple bucks to download that in-app set. It isn't an in-app purchase.
And what do you mean there's no building?
There's no traditional Minecraft. And again, that's why, you know, we need to emphasize that. This is Minecraft story mode. So you actually are, it's kind of like the Lego video games. You actually listen to two characters talk, and, you know, there's a lot of famous actor voices in this one as well.
Huh. And it's kind of pay as you go then.
Yeah. You know, it's $5 to get started. You get chapter one, and then there's two other chapters that you're going to want to play, and that's more money. And what I wish more publishers would do is tell you how much these things cost up front.
Yeah.
But they don't do that. So that's a reality that parents need to be aware of.
Let me ask you, you said you spent, you know, an hour on the first chapter. How much time do you spend actually working with these apps? Typically,
too much.
It sounds like a horrible life.
Well, it's both heaven and hell if you need to know the truth. I love finding new apps, and I also have help. I have kids that help me and other reviewers. So, mm-hmm. But it's very important to, you know, I do have to look at a lot of apps. There's no doubt about it.
Do you have to look a lot of bum apps?
Yeah. Mostly mediocre or almost great apps. It's pretty rare that you find an absolutely terrible one, but what's really, you know, the good part of my job is when I find a Goldilocks and the Little Bear, you know, that really does something different, and I know that instantly I know the kid, this could really help a kid or it could really sort of open a new world for a child. And so, you know, like give Dragonbox numbers to a budding mathematician, you might open a door that turns them into, you know, really changes their career and life. And I think that that's why we do what we do.
You know, we would always refer people to the Children's Technology Review, and there's other reviewers out there as well for these kind of things. But in general, what sort of advice do you have for parents, for people who are thinking about, you know, giving an app or, you know, buying their kid another app for something, what they should look at and what they should look for?
One piece of sage advice right now is beware of the word free, because there's a lot of free sort of teasing behavior that's going on both in the Google Play Store and in the Apple iTunes Store, and lots of Kindle, you know, this activity in the Kindle. If you, just like any material, you should play along and try it out yourself and make sure, you know, have a taste. you wouldn't give your child some food that's new to everybody mm-hmm. without taking a taste first, and that should be the same with an app. And you'll know, and then some of these you can even, like Minecraft, you can play along together, and it's a lot of fun.
You checked out the Apple TV 4th generation, and you said that it's a great iteration for kids. How so?
Yeah, it took me by surprise. So the Apple TV is $150 for the lowest, the smallest one. That's 32 gigs of storage. And so I purchased one on day one, and I was delighted to find that there were children's apps on my big screen in the living room. So all of a sudden, some of the high quality apps that could only live on an iPad or an iPhone can now be in your living room right next to, YouTube and Netflix and the other kinds of TV or movie kinds of behaviors. And the reason that's important is now children can control this giant screen. And I'm an advocate for an active child, an active learner who's controlling the world rather than the other way around. So I think that the Apple TV is a very important parenting tool because it lets you turn some of that passive TV time into active playtime. One of them I found was Star Walk Jr. So, imagine you can turn your TV into a planetarium that, children can explore the stars and that kind of thing. So I was really excited from a prior teacher point of view about that.
And if you already own an Apple TV, is it worth upgrading to the newer version because of this, do you think?
That's the reason we have this show, Anne, so we can tell people to go buy new stuff.
The answer is yes, I guess.
Yeah, the answer is...
If you have kids, yeah.
If you got the old one, it's too bad. It's still good for watching movies, but the big difference is the controller. The Apple TV 4 controller has a touch screen, a touch pad. And I've tried that with children as young as 3, and they're able to control it very easily. There's also a game controller that looks just like an Xbox or PlayStation controller, and that means that you can start playing video games that you're downloading from iTunes. Obviously, this is a big force, sort of an upsetting the apple cart, literally, for the game industry. So stay tuned on this one.
iPad Pro and Apple Pencil. So what's...
Yeah, speaking of spending more money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Now,
season.
I'm going to make people disagree with me probably because, you say give something that's $800, an iPad Pro, to a child. You're crazy. But what I discovered with this is that Pencil, which is $100 extra, so now we're up to $900 for the whole package, that Pencil is accurate. It's a Bluetooth process, so it's very different than a touch process. And that means that it has force sensitivity, and you can make very fine lines with it, and it's incredibly responsive. So I tried it out with some kids, and I couldn't get the thing back. It was game over for me. And that told me that, and I used Adobe Sketch, and then I used this app called Procreate, and both of those, the Procreate app is $10, but it's so powerful. And I started thinking, this is the kind of tool you want to give a child who is really thinking about art, because they can undo what they do, and it has all these different palettes and retinal display. And I'm telling you, the iPad Pro is a phenomenal art experience.
Well, and the thing about it is you don't have to buy it for the child. You can just let them use it once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Well, yeah, exactly.
If you can get it out of their grimy little paws, right?
Well, the thing you got to remember with the iPad Pro is it's pretty good for watching movies and, just about everything else. The other thing that I discovered is if you put an app like the Goldilocks and the Little Bear on it, it's big enough so that you can hold it up and see it across the room.
Ah.
And so all of a sudden you sort of have a big book app, and that's good. And the iPad Pro has better sound as well, so there's 4 speakers,
mm-hmm.
and you can actually fill the whole room with really great sound, and you can't do that with an iPad. So there are definitely utility. We're not going to see, I wouldn't recommend going out and buy one for your preschooler, but I would say keep an eye on it, and be aware of what it can do, because it's pretty exciting.
Warren Buckleitner, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
And it's a pleasure, and happy holidays.
Thanks. Same to you. Warren Buckleitner, he's the editor. Buckleitner, he's the editor of the Children's Technology Review. More Tech Tuesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Russell Holly of Android Central each year puts together a gift guide for Tech Tuesday listeners. Last week, he shared some ideas for younger children. You can check that out online at WOSU.org/allsides. Today, we're talking about ideas for teens and the young at heart. The new Star Wars movie is set for release this month, so toys associated with that franchise will be popular. They already are. C-3PO and R2-D2 have a new droid friend called BB-8.
I told you we would not. Oh, wait! Over here! I made us late. How dare you? So tell us, what could be so important?
Welcome back to the show, Russell.
Thank you.
So BB-8 sounds pretty cute. It's by Sphero. It's on sale now. It's a Star Wars toy. What could be wrong with it? Nothing, because you wouldn't be suggesting it if there wasn't something right about it.
No, I'm really happy with this thing. This is definitely one of the cooler things that have come out of the everything Star Wars parade that we've had over the
last couple of weeks. I mean, it's unreal how they've...
It is everywhere. I walked to the grocery store this past weekend and I saw bottles of water, coffee creamer, cookies, yogurt. Like, Star Wars is on everything right now.
I mean, they're just got to be laughing all the way to the bank. It's hysterical.
Absolutely.
But this is a winner for you.
I'm a big fan of this. This is a smartphone-controlled robot. The guys from Sphero have been working on these small smartphone-controlled robots that hover in the, you know, $100 to $200 range for a couple of years now, and their products have always been really great. Your phone basically becomes the controller. Any phone, iPhone, Android, as long as it's got a Bluetooth connection and the app on it, can drive this thing around, and it moves very, very much like you will see BB-8 move around in the movie. It's something that you have right around 50 feet of control with, so you can take out to a sidewalk or something like that and drive it around for a while or to any flat surface. It doesn't drive particularly well in like grass or something like that, but on carpet or indoors or outdoors, it handles most flat terrain pretty well.
Do you know anything about the character BB-8?
They haven't released a ton of information yet, aside from it's going to be a companion not terribly dissimilar from R2-D2.
And it sounds like it has a cute little voice.
Yeah.
It squeaks a lot. Why is this a good gift for teens?
It's something that encourages a lot of clever kind of environment stuff. You can take it pretty much anywhere. There's some really cool stuff that ties into the Star Wars universe, like the ability to record video and have it play on the phone as though it were a projected message from the robot, similar to what you saw in the Star Wars commercials. It's just a really fun way to kind of explore beginnings of robotics if you have someone who is interested in, kind of basic maneuverability for things that, don't look like your traditional kind of remote control vehicle or something like that.
You said in your article, your review of this, about how BB-8 looks a lot like a Sphero robot. You've talked about Spheros before, right? Tell us, how do they compare and contrast?
So the Sphero is just a robotic orb, very much like BB-8 without a head.
Uh-huh.
It behaves in almost exactly the same way. This is a small robot orb that you can give basic instructions to, the ability to move in straight lines. There are a ton of third-party apps for the Sphero robot that teach, kind of basics of programming, teaching how to drive the robot in, complex shapes on its own. And a lot of that kind of comes together to create this thing that I've yet to hand to someone and not have them fall in love with.
So you have been able to hand it to somebody and let go of it. But what do the kids think?
My kids absolutely love it. Every kid that I know has had a lot of fun playing with it. It's something that it's got a little bit of a learning curve when it comes to driving it, because it's not something with two or four wheels. You have to kind of learn how it turns and how to apply the appropriate speed so that you don't, you know, run it off a table or do something like that. But it's also pretty durable. I have yet to break one of these. I own three different Sphero robots, and my kids and I have abused them in various ways and have yet to actually break one. So they're definitely pretty durable and just a lot of fun to drive around.
How much did you say it was?
This one is $130, depending on what store you get it from. Some of them are on a lot of different sales. You may be able to get them a little cheaper, but probably not much before the movie comes out. But it would not surprise me if this is a little difficult to get a hold of, given the holiday season and how close we are to this movie coming out.
Mm-hmm. And you said, you know, I don't know, are your kids teenagers yet?
No. My oldest is 11.
That's what I thought. They're growing up before my eyes. So give us an age range.
Honestly, this is something from 10 to 50, really. I mean, this is something that anyone who is comfortable using a phone or a tablet to do something like, you know, drive or fly a toy is pretty much who this is aimed at.
Any other cool gift ideas from the Star Wars with the Star Wars theme that you've seen besides this?
The only other one, and I haven't used it myself, there is a quadcopter that looks like the Millennium Falcon.
Uh-huh.
That you can fly around, and it has the sound effects and lights that, you know, go along with the Millennium Falcon. I haven't flown one yet myself, but it looks so cool. It's on my list of things that I think would be pretty interesting. I think those are only available at Target.
Do you have tickets to the show yet?
I don't. I don't deal with massive crowds like that particularly well. I was going to wait until at least the week after.
Yeah, I'm the same way. Google Cardboard. I think this is fascinating. It's just a few pieces of cardboard glued together to make a virtual reality headset. How are they pulling this off?
This is something Google's been working on for 2 years now, and it's grown so much since the original announcement. This is taking your phone and making your phone do all of the virtual reality work, because it has all of the sensors in it for creating that kind of immersive 3D experience, that all you really need is a case to put it in. And so Google worked with a bunch of different manufacturers to make this as inexpensive as possible. We're talking $15 to $20 on so many different websites for this, you know, either made of cardboard or made of inexpensive plastic casing that you slide your phone into. And there are well over 100 apps that take advantage of this hardware configuration, so that when you put this thing up to your face, you get this kind of 3D immersive environment that is both videos that you can see in 360-degree rotation and games that you can play that really just kind of make you feel like you're there in a unique and again, really inexpensive way. And it's something that I've been recommending is, even if it's just a stocking stuffer, just a cool thing that anybody who has any kind of phone, this is also another one that's Android or iPhone. It works with everything.
It's so amazing that they came out with something that sort of everybody can afford to use.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a big focus for this particular team at Google, is to make it to make virtual reality something that, you know, anyone can both participate in and develop for. And a big part of that we're probably going to see next year is making it really inexpensive to capture video in that same format, so that it can be viewed in that kind of 360-degree way instead of just pointing your phone or pointing your camera at something.
So does it come assembled, or do you have to put it together?
It really depends on the kit. A lot of them come as just a thing that you can fold together. It takes, you know, 30 seconds to put together. Whereas the less expensive ones are usually a kit that you can completely assemble yourself, depending on what lenses you get and, you know, kind of how crazy you want to get with it. There are just dozens of different companies with options, including ones that have straps so that it'll actually hold it on your head instead of having to hold it up yourself. If you really want to, you know, watch a whole lot of video or something like that. But But usually you're looking at being able to assemble it pretty quickly for around $20.
And there are a lot of different versions of this cardboard headset. Any ones you particularly recommend?
The ones that are made by IM Cardboard is the name of the company that you'll find on Amazon seem to be the closest to Google's original design. So they're you know kind of well built and pretty easy to replace. But they're all very, very similar. So
If you were thinking about getting a virtual reality headset for the holidays, would something like the Samsung Gear headset be a better option in the long term, or any thoughts about that?
So the Samsung Gear VR is limited to Samsung's four big phones from this year, the Galaxy S6 and S6 Edge and S6 Edge Plus and the Note 5. And they do more than Google Cardboard. It's $100. So the $80 difference, you get some better head tracking, better straps so that it more comfortably fits your head, and access to a bunch of different applications. You get higher quality games, access to Netflix if you really want to sit by yourself and watch movies for a while. you know, a lot of different things that you have access to that are different from this this kind of entry-level virtual reality experience. So you do get a lot more for that $80 difference, but it is an $80 difference, and it applies only to those four Samsung phones.
And as far as the, you said it works with Apple or Android, does it have to be pretty high-end or?
No, really. Okay. I mean, just about any phone will fit in this thing and work pretty well. I mean, it's gotten to a point, Google has got this down to, if you can play a YouTube video, then you can do some stuff with VR, basically.
And what about a headache or anything like that?
So there's some natural warnings that come along with any of this stuff. You know, using it for more than, I'd say, about a half an hour, it puts some strain on my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some pretty significant warnings about letting kids under the age of 13 use them for particularly long. I actually spoke to a pediatrician not too long ago about it. So it's definitely designed to be something that you use in short bursts.
Okay, something to goof around with a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, and stocking stuffer sounds great. $15-$20, that's not bad at all.
Right.
Cool. You want to talk about MacBook Air. That seems like a really nice gift for a teen.
It does. And this is the big question that I get asked every year is, you know, people looking for a new laptop, you know, what is a good starter laptop? And it is often hard to look at their faces when I suggest spending $1,000 on a laptop. But consistently, Apple's MacBook line has been something that I've been able to recommend to people that have lasted, you know, multiple years without problems, without, you know, feeling like the computer has slowed down. You know, the current generation MacBook Air is a lot of really great hardware at what I would consider a pretty reasonable price given what's in it and how well built it is. And it's something that has demonstrated in the past that it's going to last a while. So if you're considering a laptop for a child who is entering high school or who is, you know, ready for that kind of first computer and you want something that you think is going to last a while, the MacBook Air is the direction that I usually point people.
And what do you compare it to with what else is out there? What's it comparable to?
The biggest thing that I compare it to is the Microsoft Surface.
Okay.
You know, the computers that are out there within that kind of $1,000 price range that you'll find at Best Buy or something like that.
Okay. All right. Well, Russell Holly, thank you so much for this latest edition of your holiday gift guide.
Thank you for having me.
That's Russell Holly, contributing editor for Android Central. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, All Sides interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks a lot for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.